from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with art historian and curator Mark Smith about printmaking.
I'll get a preview of a new Freetown Village show.
Then IMA contemporary art curator Sarah Green and I will talk about the upcoming Ai Weiwei exhibit. And there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Mark L. Smith is a visual arts professional with 35 years of experience in modern and contemporary art. He has forged a dual career in higher education and in private business. Equipped with a PhD in the history and criticism of art from the University of Texas at Austin, Dr. Smith has served as an art department chairman, an associate dean in fine arts, and a teacher of art history and studio art, and he's recently moved to Indianapolis. Travis DiNicola sat down with Smith to learn more.
Mark, welcome to Art of the Matter, and welcome to Indianapolis as well.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Great to have you here, and been looking forward to our conversation. We just met a little bit ago, and you're a relatively new artist in town, not a new artist by trade at all. Tell me a bit about your background. I know you just moved here recently in the past year from Austin, Texas, where you've been working for many years.
Yes. Well, my background is essentially in the visual arts altogether, but I started out as a studio artist, and I still do my own work. But at a certain point, I did academic work in art history, a master's degree, and then a PhD. And so I've also done a lot of administrative work as an associate dean and as a teacher and so forth. But I also write a lot and do independent curating, so I'm basically an art guy all around.
All around, in every possible way. Making it, scholarly work, and now, I mean, here you have Mark L. Smith, Fine Art Editions. I mean, that's the work that you're doing now. I mean, so tell me, I mean, and sort of how you've grown into that.
Okay, I'll tell you what that is. For the last 23 years or so, I've been the co-founder and co-director of a publishing workshop in Austin, Texas. And essentially, that is a large printmaking studio called Flatbed Press. And it's still ongoing, but when we left Austin, I decided to sell out my part of the business and then reestablish myself here. So part of my deal was to bring quite a bit of that inventory of those prints with me. So I became an instant print dealer, and I operate by appointment out of a home studio and gallery. So that's what I was marketing at the Art and Antiques Fair just recently.
Yeah, so at that fair, and we were just chatting about that before we went on the air. It sounds like you did well, which is great. I mean, that's a big event.
It was successful. It was very good context for me, good meeting people, and made some sales. So I felt like it was definitely worth the effort. The other part of what I do to give you a little better look at my background is I have a website about my art consulting and independent curating. So I also write a lot and curate exhibitions as well.
Well, let's talk about the printmaking side of this and the work that you're carrying. Can you tell me a bit about the type of work, the artist, the style? I mean, you know, one thing that always I find interesting, especially with printmaking, is why a particular artist chooses to go the direction of making their work as prints as opposed to, let's say, you know, paintings or drawings or what have you.
Right. That's an excellent question. And there are several answers to that question. There was a time in the late 19th century in this country and the early 20th century when printmaking was kind of the stepchild of the art world. People were doing rather small impressions of etchings and lithographs and so forth. But in the 40s and 50s...
And a lot was being done to illustrate books.
That's right. A lot was illustration.
Or postcards or what have you.
And a lot of it was actually reproductive work done by artisans who would look at a painting and turn it into a lithograph or an etching. So when the WPA project happened, a lot of artists were really encouraged to do their work in printmaking.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those artists then, after the war, became teachers. And also some European printmakers immigrated to this country and began teaching printmaking. So by the 60s, there was this kind of print boom,
mm-hmm.
Where printmaking began to hold its own with painting in scale and ambition and so forth. And during those years, what happened was painters and sculptors and photographers and all kinds of artists began to do printmaking as another part of what they did. They would keep doing their primary medium, but they also wanted to do prints. And so they choose to do that for a lot of reasons. One is it provides a nice, democratic, affordable medium for collectors.
Right.
So it's easy to collect to work on paper when you can't collect a big steel sculpture.
Because you can have multiple editions
as opposed
to one. And whether it's, you know, one of five or one of 50 or 500, I mean, and certainly there's variations depending on the type of technique.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And there are artistic reasons, too. For one thing, a lot of artists are solo workers in their studio all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they go to a collaborative printmaking workshop, they may not know how to make prints initially, but
mm-hmm.
they work with master printers who help them make it happen. So they collaborate with them, and they become kind of a team with that master printer. It's a very different way of working than working as a solo painter, let's say. And many artists enjoy that process. There are a few who don't, but most do, actually.
So tell me a little bit more about that, because, you know, you think, okay, if an artist is a good artist, you know, and they've got great illustration skills, whatever it may be,
mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that just naturally transfer? I mean, oh, with a print, all you have to do is draw it backwards, right? But there's actually,
That's true. Well, the key to this is understanding that the prints that we're talking about are actually multiple originals.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like an oxymoron, but instead of them being reproductions of something an artist has already done, they come into the studio and create a whole new image from scratch specifically for the purpose of using it in a limited edition of prints.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why each impression that comes off of the stone or the plate or the block is considered a multiple original. And there are really good artistic reasons why artists like to do this too,
yeah.
Because often what they do in the print studio, partly because it's very experimental, they get new ideas about what they can do in their sculpture or their painting, for example. So it functions often as a kind of stimulus for them to go back to their studio and do the work that they normally do. We find that artists often will take ideas that were generated in the studio, in the printmaking studio, back into their home studio.
So the work that that you carry, can you say that there's one or a particular style, more abstract, more figurative, landscape, more recent work by artists? Or?
Well, we had a motto that we would always make the artist central to the process and
mm-hmm.
the image central to the process. So we never really specialized on a particular style
okay.
or a particular subject. We would have the artist bring in some of their work and show us what they were doing at that moment.
But working all with contemporary artists as opposed to...
That's right.
Okay.
That's
mm-hmm.
right. We worked only with living artists.
Mm-hmm.
We started working with Austin, Texas artists, and then we branched out to Texas artists and then to American artists and then some foreign artists. So we just kind of spread out as we went through time. So we worked with artists from all over the country and all over the world. And it depended on what they liked to do and what their style was.
Mm-hmm.
We would give them a couple of choices in printmaking and say, well, maybe you should try a lithograph or maybe you should try an etching. And we'd do a little test plate just to make
okay.
sure that we guessed right. And then we would start on the big project. And we would help them know how long to leave the plate in the acid. And
so you were really working as a consultant to the artist.
That's exactly
well.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting collaboration. It's,
huh.
it's sort of like a dance that you work out between this master printer and the artist. Some artists don't need much help.
Mm-hmm.
And other artists rely on that master printer a lot more heavily. So it's a beautiful thing to watch, actually, when it works right.
Well, tell me about some of the other work you're doing now that you're here in Indianapolis.
Well, one of the things that I discovered about Indianapolis, just before I came here, I was doing some research on the Tamarin Institute of Lithography, working on an exhibition for the Amon Carter Museum. And I discovered that some of the founders, some of the most important founders of the Tamarin Institute.
And where is the Tamarin Institute?
The Tamarin Institute started in 1960 in L.A.
Okay.
And then it moved in 1970 to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where it now is.
Okay.
But the first technical director of the Tamarin Institute of Lithography was Garo Antrazian, who had just graduated from the Heron School of Art.
Okay.
And then later, not too much later, Ken Tyler who was a graduate of the Heron School, mm-hmm. came out to be one of the master printers at Tamron. And then it later moved to Albuquerque. But those were really important foundational years for the Tamron Institute. So when I came here, I already had a kind of connection, I felt like, with the Heron School. And, of course, they have one of the best printmaking programs in the United States.
Sure they do. Mm-hmm.
So I was excited to be around that. And I'll be teaching there a little bit this coming fall. So it was interesting to me that Indianapolis had such a great history in printmaking.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Very, very cool. Well, that's great that that you've made that connection with Heron as well. Can you tell me a little bit about the work that you've done as a curator or as a consultant?
Sure. A lot of it has to do with writing for catalogs and so forth. I'm working now on a big book about flatbed press that UT Press is going to publish, and writing another essay about an artist named Dan Rizzi, who's one of the artists that we worked with a lot.
Okay.
So that's a book that they're doing on Dan Rizzi. So I do quite a bit of writing. And then this exhibition I'm working on for the Amon Carter, I'll be an independent curator for them as a guest curator, doing a show about their collection of Tamron prints. They have about 2,500 of very fine prints from 1960 to 1970.
Okay.
So I'm working on that exhibition as well. And then I also do corporate consulting. You know, if there's a corporation that really wants to have an art collection, I'm very happy to help them assemble that.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here for my last question, Mark.
Okay.
So you've been in Indianapolis now since moving here from Texas with your wife about a year or so. What's your general view of our arts community here?
Well, it's been actually very interesting because it looks to me as though Indianapolis is in a transitional phase right now that's very good, that a lot of vitality is here. A lot of growth is happening. I recognize that from years back in Austin when Austin was just beginning to kind of take off, and I see a lot of the similar things happening here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very encouraged by the art scene that I see here. I'm looking forward to getting more involved in it.
Well, excellent. Mark Smith, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Matter today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Travis DiNicola with art consultant and historian Dr. Mark L. Smith. To learn more, visit his website at marklsmithart.com, marklsmithart.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
You can learn about the life of self-made millionaire Madam C.J. Walker in a new Freetown Village performance that takes place monthly at the Madam Walker Theater. Sharon Gamble invited Freetown Village's Ophelia Wellington to our studios to learn about the performances and why they're told from the point of view of a friend of Madam Walker.
So do you remember when you first learned about Madam C.J. Walker?
You know, I really don't know that I do. I'm from St. Louis, and Madam Walker spent a time in St. Louis.
Did she? Didn't know that.
And she studied with a woman named Annie Malone, who also did hair care preparations. And Annie Malone is big in St. Louis. And I think I remember hearing about Madam Walker, but I really cannot recall until after I got here and found out about Madam Walker being in Indianapolis. Then it took some research for me to connect. Oh, yeah, she was in St. Louis. Okay. But I didn't make that connection right off.
Can you set the scene for us? Because, you know, listeners under a certain age will be like, what's the big deal? I've always been able to buy products tailored to my hair, no matter what my hair is. But take us back to that era.
Well, for a lot of things that we as Black people have, African Americans, there's not always a counterpart for us. And we have to make do. And with the hair care, even the lotions, there are things that, you know, that are particularly beneficial to us. So you have to find out where they are. I remember when I went to IU Bloomington back in the 60s, we had a hard time finding hair care products for us, so we had to make sure we brought them with us or have someone to send them to us. And this is like in the 20th century.
Right, not that long ago.
Yeah, so for a lot of the Blacks who were in America, there were not stores they could go to buy products. No one was really making them. I guess people didn't think of Black people having a desire to be groomed and to look professional. So many people made their own hair care products. And Madam Walker, Annie Malone were some of the forerunners of going to the kitchen sink and dibble and dabbling and creating products that worked. And I'm sure there was a lot of experimentation, but it was just, you know, the oils that are needed to groom my hair, and even just the techniques of how to use, how much, don't use too much, use just enough, and mm-hmm. so forth.
Now, did were there men involved doing some research as well, or was this kind of a woman-driven industry?
Now, as far as I know, and I haven't done a whole lot of research on that particular subject,
sure,
just primarily on Madam Walker, but I can't imagine that men were not. However, a lot of men would go to the barber and have their hair cut off, so that it was not as big of a deal for men. And this is me just saying this, as
sure,
it would be for women who would desire to have hair with length or some style to it. So for women, it was probably more of something that they needed and would mm-hmm. pursue.
So how do we go from the early days? Madam Walker was how old when she was just getting started doing this, experimenting at home and trying to create her own products?
Well, that's a good question. The age, I don't remember how old she was, but she was young.
Yeah.
And when she left St. Louis, she went to Denver, and that's when she really started experimenting on her own. But she went originally with the purpose of expanding Annie Malone's product line. But when she got there, she thought, oh, I could do this myself. And she probably, now she may have used some of the original formula of Annie Malone, but she also created her own.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband, the man that she eventually married, was Charles Joseph Walker. He was an advertiser,
oh,
a man who worked in advertising. And he helped her to promote her products. So she was the original door-to-door Fuller Brush, Avon, Colleen, what's the other lady? The Mary Kay kind of product,
mm-hmm.
where she drew people in to get them to be salespeople. And when the women, mostly women, who sold her products, were able to make a lot more money selling her products than they ever could as a domestic or any kind of a servant. And so they were making money that they had never even imagined.
Hmm.
And they were selling it to women who now in freedom wanted to look better, take better care of themselves. Because Madam Walker's hair was falling out. And that's one of the reasons that propelled her to want to find something that was going to help her with her hair care. She was in a very stressful life, and she was married before she married Charles Joseph. It was a bad marriage and all kind of other things that were going on in her life, so probably stress and lack of proper hygiene and taking care of her hair and so forth. So she said, I got to do something better about myself, and I want to look good too.
Enlightened self-interest.
That's true.
That changed the lives of so many.
So many people from then and even through today.
I can see how, this much hasn't changed in a digital age. If you find something, some product that you like that works, you tell your friends, whether it's a new kind of, you know, food product or personal care product, you tell your friends. You might do it on Facebook instead of, you know, seeing them at the coffee and donuts after the church service, but
yes,
you
mm-hmm.
tell your friends, and you could see how that would percolate through generations of the same family.
Well, you know, that word of mouth, even for those of us who are in trying to promote our programming, a lot of the evaluations that we do with Freetown Village, we ask people, well, how did you find out about our program?
Mm-hmm.
And the number one answer hereafter is always from a friend. We will trust a friend's recommendation more so than we will an advertiser whose sole purpose is to get us to buy something so they make the money. But a friend has an invested interest in us.
Mm-hmm.
So that door-to-door, and again, people were door-to-door. It was a community. People worked together. They went to church together. They shopped at the same stores and walked up and down the streets together. So it was a good way of passing the information along. And when she moved to Indianapolis, she moved to Pittsburgh before she came to Indianapolis, but when she came to Indianapolis, it was because it was the crossroads of America. the trains could transport her products throughout the country. And Indianapolis or Indiana was fairly centrally located in our country. So that was her motivation for being here. Now, the building that's on Indiana Avenue and West Street was built after she died. She never saw that building, but it was a desire of hers. Her daughter actually helped to make that building a reality. But her daughter kind of followed in her footsteps for a while, but she really didn't manage the business well. And I think that's what happens a lot with second-generation children. They just don't have the passion that their parents have.
Sure, it's more of an obligation than, right. Yeah, a
they
calling.
They share in the benefits of it, but they don't have the drive and that stick-to-itiveness. But Madam was such an entrepreneur, and she was such a philanthropist, that that's probably what killed her, because she didn't take time out to rest. She didn't take her doctor's advice,
mm-mm.
And she died at an early age, and I've forgotten exactly how old she was, but I think I've already lived longer than Madam did, so she was a young woman.
She was driven.
Yes.
So did the company survive after the next generation, or was it sold, or what happened next?
It did survive, and there were several... one of the problems that affected that company was the Depression.
Hmm.
And a lot of the employees were laid off, and of course people were not using their disposable income for hair care products.
Sure. They needed it for food.
Survival.
Yeah.
So it did go through a slowdown during the Depression era.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of gradually began to take root again, but it never was as strong as it had been when Madam was at the head of it.
Now, did she travel in service of promoting these products as well?
In service of promoting the product, in service of finding investors. She also spoke out a lot for freedom, for rights, for civil rights. During this time, there were a lot of lynchings. Blacks were still lynching. Many of us here in Indiana are familiar with the lynching in Marion, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was a strong... she spoke out against that, and civil rights was her passion. So that, plus promoting her business, is what she did. And she was gone a lot. She was on the road a lot and just wore herself down.
Mm-hmm. What's most, in your research to create this this interpretation, what's the most surprising thing that you found out about her or her world, her universe?
Well, I think for me it was finding out that she spent so much time in St. Louis, where I grew up. And in reading the research, there were certain streets and buildings that were in the research. I know that building. I know that street. Well, it may no longer be there now, but
sure.
It was when I was a child. So for me, it was making that connection to her from St. Louis. And then to also see how much money she made and how much money she gave away. She was a very kind-hearted person, and she empowered a lot of people, a lot of women who would have never been able to provide for their families, because a lot of the men had difficulty finding work. And for a lot of the women, they were domestics most of the time and making just change. And so for them to be able to have their own business and to be able to go to school for that, I mean, see how they call them, the hair culturist. They
mm-hmm.
were called hair culturists. And it just raised the community wherever she went. And she left Indianapolis. She went to New York. And that's where she was when she died, in New York.
We kind of claim her as our own.
I'm sure every place claims successful people. No matter, was it everyone? Lincoln slept here? No, Washington
right,
slept
right.
here. Lincoln was...
Had a childhood experience here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody claims those who are famous. But in creating the program, it was the research, and what we do, it's a one-character story. And it's not Madam Walker. It's a friend of Madam Walker. And she tells the story of Madam being born in the South in Mississippi or Louisiana, and her parents died. She was the first in her family to be born in freedom.
Mm.
And her parents died when she was at a young age. And she lived with her sister. And she married young, probably because, well, what else am I going to do?
Sure.
And her first husband was he was killed in a race riot. And then her second husband was the one who was abusive. But she left Mississippi and moved to St. Louis. And the only work she could find was being a washerwoman. But anyway, we tell her story, her early years as well as her latter years. And it's told from, as I said, a person who grew up or who knew Madam Walker. And that way, we're not, we have some liberty, some creative license liberty to tell stories in a way that Madam would not tell on herself.
Sure.
But it makes it more of a complete story. Sometimes we talk about famous people. We only talk about the great things that they did. Not that she was a bad person, but there's some other parts of the story that she probably just wouldn't talk about. But it's still interesting to know those things that she did.
That even someone so laudable, someone we want to emulate, had foibles.
Yes. Yes, that's true. But she was really well, she was driven. She was extremely driven and doing things that many people would not want her to do. But she just had the vision and she pursued it and she was extremely successful. And according to the research, she was the first woman to earn $1 million. And most women who had wealth, they inherited it or they married into it. But she actually earned it, you know, dollar on dollar.
Hard
on
dollar by hard dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Sharon Gamble with Ophelia Wellington of Freetown Village, a living history museum without walls. You can see the Madam Walker story at the Museum and Heritage Center, 623 Indiana Avenue, with 25-minute performances from 10 a.m. until 2 p.m. on the second Thursday of the month through December. So the next two performance days are April 11th and May 9th. Performances are free and open to groups and individuals of all ages. Before or after the performance, visitors can examine original and period artifacts, photographs, and exhibits about Madam Walker and Indiana Avenue in the Museum and Heritage Center. Find out more at freetown.org. Again, freetown.org.
Oh, Travis?
Yes, Sharon?
I have an orderly introduction to our opening that we call... of calendar items that we call
What'll
We
Do? Sharon.
Do you know where I'm going
with this? It sounds like there's
this?
An O theme here.
There is
that
an overabundance
correct?
Of opportunities to opine.
What a great way to open the calendar.
Up. What's with all the O's anyway? Well, the Alphabet Affair benefiting Indie Reads is celebrating the letter O this
year. And sponsored
year.
By FYI is
and
one of our sponsors.
Sponsored by
that's
FYI.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about this fundraiser, which I'm happy to have attended many times, is you can be traditional and attend in black tie attire, or you can be fun and creative and come as something themed to the letter of the year. So,
ooh.
I mean, orangutan, mm-hmm. Oscar, old-timer, officer, octopus, opera star...
Think of the options.
Think of the options.
Well, and this year,
someone called Oscar. You could go as, you know, one of you could go as Felix and the other as Oscar.
Or Oscar the Grouch.
Oscar the Grouch.
There's also an Oscar theme this year, so you can go like you're going to the Oscars or
it.
From an Oscar winning movie.
I love it. So when is this fun thing? Now that you have an idea of your costume in your head, it's April 20th. April 20th. So that's coming up very quickly. And Travis, I'll bet you know when RSVPs are due.
Well, try to get them in by, I'd like to buy the 10th, but the 15th would probably be okay.
Okay.
But, you didn't hear it here.
All right. But make Travis and his staff less nervous and reserve your tickets sooner rather than later. You can get more information at indiereads.org. Why, there's even an O in your website, indiereads.org.
Nice.
You could come as a .org.
You could come as a .org.
I don't know what that looks like.
I do
like,
have
but...
to say that Chef Pavar of the Hyatt has created an amazing O-themed meal. Four courses and everything from the opening appetizer with omelets and oxtail to a salad with ostrich and then
ossobuca
and the Ono fish for the main course. And
I
then
just pictured Yoko Ono.
Yoko,
I'm sorry.
Not Yoko Ono, no. And then an Oreo cheesecake for the dessert. It's all so
amazing. Cafe Olay.
Oh, there you go. So it should be a lot of fun.
Yes, I know how it's spelled. Don't send your email to artofthematter@wfyi.org.
Hey, just a heads up, of course, for another event, a fun one, of course, going on at the Harrison Center this weekend. It's First Friday, and lots of great galleries and things are open, of course, including contents may have shifted at Harrison Center. I mean, there are other openings all around town, of course, at the Wheeler and Fountain Square and stuff, but contents may have shifted. Sounds like it's just a great title. How can you miss that one out? And Harrison Center, of course, is at 16th and Delaware, and it's part of their cultural exchange program, Global Art Exchange, that they are featuring some artists from other countries, including from Perth, Australia. And this is Bernice Rarig, who is going to be showing her work for Contents May Have Shifted. So the artist is asking attendees to bring, are you ready for this, Sharon? Unbroken Wishbones, Thorns from Red Roses, and books whose titles contain the word more for inclusion in an ongoing interactive installation. How fun. So even if you miss the opening night Friday, you can still bring come by to the Harrison later and bring your wishbones and thorns. And
how will we know the thorns are from red roses?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I don't know. Maybe they can do some DNA testing or something.
If you're a horticulturalist specializing in roses, send us the answer, please. Hey, speaking of visual art, mm-hmm. you'll hear more about this on an upcoming Art of the Matter, but the Stutz Artists Association is looking for volunteers for their artist open house. The open house is on Friday, April 26th and Saturday, April 27th. No, you don't have to volunteer the entire time, but you need to work at least 1 3-hour shift. For that, you'll get an event t-shirt and admission to the 2-day event. You might be doing things like helping move equipment, help entertainers get set up, replenishing trash bags or setting out food and beverage. You need to be at least 18 years old. And what a great fun event at the Stutz building, of course. You do need to apply by April 15th, tax day. And where you do that is stutzartists.com. That's S-T-U-T-Z artists.com. Stutz like the car.
Cool.
Yay.
Hey, coming up next weekend, Mind Power presents A Night of Magic and Hypnosis. You know I love this type of stuff, Sharon. This is fun. It's featuring close-up magician Craig Stone and master hypnotist Jeff Jay. I love hypnotism shows, too. They're fun.
Who are you?
Yeah, okay. Well, it takes place on April 13th at 7 a.m. when the doors open. Entertainment begins at 8, and it's at Dave and Buster's up Castle and Corner Cross from the mall. So, again, that's next weekend.
You want to check that time again?
7 p.m.?
Yeah. I think you said a.m.
Oh, okay. Well, that'd be a very early
that
show.
That would be a very
so,
early
7
show.
7 p.m. Entertainment begins at 8 p.m. There we go. You can get more information at magicalpresentations.com.
I love it. Stop hypnotizing me. Stop it, I tell you. Hey, there's a beautiful film.
Getting very sleepy.
I'm thinking about Beethoven's string quartets. Wait a minute. How would that be different from my normal self?
Yeah, exactly.
Self? beautiful film that played at art houses a little bit earlier this year. It's called A Late Quartet. It takes place in the setting of the members of a string quartet dealing with something that changes their dynamic. That's all I'll tell you in case you haven't seen it. It's available for rental and through libraries now. On the soundtrack, you heard performances by the Brentano Quartet, and that ensemble is coming to town on April 10th, that's next Wednesday, to perform music by Henry Purcell and two quartets by Beethoven, including the Harp Quartet. So you can get more information about that. They're coming to town under the auspices of Ensemble Music Society, so ensemblemusic.org will get you a little bit more information and tickets for that April 10th concert at the Indiana History Center.
Very good. Hey, we'll be back next week with more of
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Ai Weiwei may be one of the most important living artists in the world. He certainly is the most significant contemporary Chinese artist, and his work is coming to the Indianapolis Museum of Art, even if the artist is forbidden to. Featuring over 30 works spanning more than 20 years, Ai Weiwei, According to What, opens this weekend. Travis DiNicola spoke with contemporary curator Sarah Green to learn more.
This is, I think, a really exciting show that we're going to be talking about, Ai Weiwei at the IMA, which, as we just said, is fun to say. You know what's interesting about Ai Weiwei is, for people who know him, they're probably thinking, my gosh, this is great, the IMA is having this, this is one of the most important artists in the world. And then the other half of the population are going, what are you talking about? Who is this guy?
Who is Ai Weiwei?
Yeah.
Which is actually the theme of our pre-marketing campaign. We're going to try to pepper about the city some little stickers and T-shirts that says that say, who is Ai Weiwei? Who is he is an important question. And I think also to identify that he's... that Ai Weiwei is a person, number
mm-hmm.
one,
right.
which who establishes. Mm-hmm. But for those who know, they do know that he is a very prominent political figure, mm-hmm. activist, dissident, and also an artist. And a lot of people know him from his three-month detention mm-hmm. when he was detained by the Chinese government in 2011. And there was a very vocal protest against that detention, and he was eventually released. But a lot of people know him as a humanitarian, as a rights activist, and they don't necessarily know what his art looks like.
Yeah.
His work hasn't been seen that much in the United States.
That's the part that's really interesting to me about this. I mean, there's been a lot of coverage about him, and there's a great profile in The New Yorker maybe a year ago. There's a documentary that PBS did that, in fact, has run here on WFYI just during the past month, and other coverage. I mean, even I think it was last year when the Nobel Prizes were being given out, there was talk of, will Ai Weiwei get this prize or not? You know, and it didn't happen, but still was, you know, I mean, the fact that, you know, his name was being, you know, put out there. But again, it's all about sort of the ideas behind his work and not necessarily his work. And in some ways, that's almost appropriate because so much of his work is very conceptual.
It is.
And let me ask you this, Sarah, because I mean, you know his work better than I do, and I've been learning more about it, though, and I've become a big fan. I'm so excited to see the show. But it seems as though a lot of his work, even though it was he trained as a visual artist initially and was living in New York back in the 80s, early 90s, it didn't seem like his work became political until maybe the past 5-6 years. I mean, he was always sort of conceptual and edgy and would push buttons and mm-hmm. maybe more trying to be a provocateur of the art world than the political world. But
That he has been an activist mm-hmm. for a while, I think, is because his father was a very well-known poet and intellectual, I Ching. He and his family were exiled during the Cultural Revolution. You know, his life has been political from the start, let's
okay.
say.
Yeah.
But when he and his family returned to Beijing in the late 70s, pretty much right away, I became involved in sort of pro-democracy actions and also organizing with artists to promote free speech and the rights of artists. So it has been a thread throughout his life, but yes, he mm-hmm. has become more active. And it's funny that you say 2005 or, you know, about 5 or 6 years ago, because that's when he actually started blogging for the first time.
And that's really been such a huge part of his work. I mean, his presence on Twitter, his blogs. Tell me more about that.
I think he's always been an activist, but discovering the internet and really harnessing the power of the internet has given him a much louder voice.
Mm-hmm.
He started a blog in 2005. And then blogged just almost obsessively until 2009 when his blog was taken down. And it's been a really, really important outlet for him and a platform for promoting human rights and different issues in contemporary Chinese culture.
And that's really, I mean, so much about his work is about now, is looking at human rights issues in China, sort of calling attention to sometimes the absurdity of how the Chinese government deals with human rights
mm-hmm.
issues.
Well, and I think in a wider sense, you know, he's looking at contemporary Chinese society mm-hmm. and he's trying to grapple with the predicaments that accompany it. I think throughout the show, you see works that are about the tremendous change that's occurred in China over the past several decades, the change that's occurred in cities, the mm-hmm. destruction of traditional neighborhoods and architecture to literally pave over to make way for modern buildings.
Yeah.
I mean, another earlier political work that he did was from 1995, and that was dropping a Han Dynasty urn.
Now, this image is pretty famous.
It is.
And I remember, I mean, I just was blown away by it the first time I saw it, just because it's a great image, even before I knew the value or the history of that urn that he was dropping and is crashing on the pavement in front of him, and he's sort of got this nonplussed look on his face as he's doing that. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that piece.
So the piece is a photographic triptych.
Mm-hmm.
So it's three photos. You see him holding the Han Dynasty urn, and then you see it drop in midair, and then you see it crash to the ground. And, you know, a Han Dynasty urn is over 2,000 years old. It's an antiquity. It's valued. It has a very high value on the Chinese antiquity market.
Sure.
And to drop it.
It's a cultural icon. And clearly he knows what he's doing by dropping it. I mean,
he does.
It wasn't like he just, you know, knocked it over by accident.
His cousin is an expert in antiquities, and he mm-hmm. knew exactly what he was doing. And I think this, again, is connected to him thinking about the changes that are occurring in China. China has such a long history and a rich history. And he's asking very provocatively, why, what are we doing? Our cities are being destroyed, are being remade. And yes, you know, reform is good in some ways, but it's also bad in others. And so what, you know, in destruction mm-hmm. can also be a creative act.
Because he's making artwork by destroying another work of art.
He mm-hmm. is. And that's not unprecedented in the history of art.
So it still upsets a lot of people.
It does. And it raises questions. Actually, the full title of the exhibition is Ai Weiwei, According to What?
Mm-hmm.
And that is the title of a 1964 painting by Jasper Johns. And when Ai Weiwei first encountered the work of Jasper Johns, he saw it in a book before he lived in the U.S., and he thought it was so ridiculous that an artist would include real paintbrushes or real items mm-hmm. in a painting, and he thought that it wasn't art. And he threw it away. He remembers throwing away a Jasper Johns book. And it wasn't until his time in the U.S. when he started to really reconsider that he became really intrigued by that issue of what is art, mm-hmm. you know, is it, and who says it's art and who says it's valuable. You know, there's other works that he's done where he's dipping Neolithic vases into industrial paint.
Right, right. Very bright colors. And those works are going to be on exhibit, right,
as part
of this show.
They mm-hmm. are. Very shown very near the dropping of the urn photos. And in a similar way, I think he's asking what's authentic, what's fake, mm-hmm. And who determines that.
Now, tell me how the show was put together, because Ai Weiwei will not be coming to the United States for the show. He is in China right now. I believe he's still detained there. He's not allowed to leave the country.
He hasn't been given his passport back
now,
so he can't come, unfortunately.
This exhibit just closed at the Hirshhorn, is now coming to the IMA, is going to a couple other stops on a North American tour. How did this exhibit come about? Has he been involved in it?
Definitely. This show originated at the Mori Art Museum in Tokyo, and the curator's name is Mami Katowaka. And the show was originally held in 2009. And of course, a lot's happened between 2009 and now mm-hmm. when it opened at the Hirshhorn in DC. And so the curator of the show worked directly with I to formulate what the show should be. And it's quite different. And he thought about it, he thought about the works and what would be relevant for an American audience.
And this is the first major show of his work in the United States.
It is. Yeah. It is. His work has been seen, mm-hmm. but in smaller groupings. And this is really the first major retrospective to travel in North America.
So. Again, kind of awesome that we have it at the IMA. I mean that's really cool.
So.
Yeah, I mean, and like I said, I mean, for people who are familiar with his work and understand his significance, you know, in the art world right now, he is one of the most important, you know, artists working today. And so to have this, you know, this first show here in the United States, the second stop being the IMA, I mean, when I heard it was announced, I was just blown away. I was thrilled by it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you responded that way. Yeah, his work is very important, and I think we have a really sophisticated art audience here,
mm-hmm.
And also, you know, this work appeals to an art audience, but it also appeals to people who are interested in things happening around the world. You know, Ai Weiwei is confronting really universal issues about freedom of speech, about human rights, about the changing and modernization of cities, and these are things that are relevant to a very wide group of people.
Now, so much of his work now is, it doesn't create necessarily a physical object. It is conceptual, as we talked about somewhat. I mean, when he was still able to do his blog, some of the stuff he's done with mm-hmm. Twitter and other social media. How is that being conveyed in the show?
Well, one thing that we are going to have in our display that was not at the Hirshhorn is we've mm-hmm. developed an iPad app that you'll be able to interact with in the galleries that really sort of fleshes out the other side of his life, okay. Learning more about his activities outside of art making.
Mm-hmm.
And also we've posed a series of questions to him that he's created video answers to that
oh,
you'll
cool.
be able to see and then add your response.
Okay.
So that's something that we've really tried to do to increase the context for it. But also, you know, you'll see a lot of his outside interests in the work.
Mm-hmm.
Something that he's made a lot of artworks about is the 2008 Sichuan earthquake disaster.
Right.
And he started a citizen's investigation through the internet and through his blog originally. That was an effort to gather the names of the many school children who died in shoddily constructed schoolhouses in that region. And so that
was such a, in some ways, a radical activity because the names were not being released. The Chinese government was not admitting exactly how many children were killed in that earthquake.
That's right.
I mean, just by collecting those names became quite a political act.
Where
it seems
right.
like such a simple thing. But...
Right. And you know, such a seemingly uncontroversial thing to try to memorialize these children, but I think it was mostly an attempt to not place blame anywhere because of those poorly constructed schools.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, a lot of people think that that's why his blog was shut down, even though it was never clearly articulated. But that list of names will be in the galleries. There's almost a Vietnam War memorial type wall that is a list of those names along with the children's birth date and the grade of school that they were in. But in some ways, you know, that is an artwork
mm-hmm.
that's on the wall, of course, but there's a more physical sculpture that will be in the same space that is dealing with those issues in a different way. He also collected a lot of mangled rebar
mm-hmm.
from the destroyed schoolhouses, and he took it back to his studio and worked with many people over the course of a long time to straighten each of those twisted sections of rebar, and they will be arranged on the floor in a very minimal landscape that is its own memorial to the children who died.
One of the things that he does, working with so many other people that are part of his studio, collaborators, at least in the physical making of the work
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah, he's less concerned about being the creator in a formal sense. I mean, he is a conceptual artist. They're his ideas. But I think he deals with that issue differently than, say, artists associated with minimalism in the mm-hmm. U.S. who would draw up a plan for something and give it to an industrial fabricator.
Sure.
Ai Weiwei works with traditional Chinese artisans for the most part. I mean, you know, he worked with construction workers, let's mm-hmm. say, for the rebar piece. But for some of his earlier sculptures from the 90s, where he's remaking pieces of antique furniture,
mm-hmm.
He will hire traditional craftsmen and woodworkers and use very fine joinery techniques. And it's part of his concern to kind of celebrate celebrate those craftsmen and those techniques and promote them.
Well, in one, I think it was article I was reading, I really got a sense that, I mean, people love him because he pushes the boundaries, he pokes at the government, but he also is a great employer.
I mean, right.
you know, which is
yeah, you can't deny that.
Yeah, a very important thing. I know that. I mean, obviously, you've got this campaign. You know, who is Ai Weiwei? But once the exhibit opens, there's also going to be a number of other things going on that sort of, I think, will help audiences understand more about Ai Weiwei, film events and other activities as well.
Right. We will be screening the same documentary that you mentioned that you've screened at WFYI. That will be showing several times over a weekend in May. We'll have our opening night event that will be on Thursday, April 4th.
Right when the show airs.
Tonight. is bringing in two experts, Lee Ambrosi, who actually edited the book Ai Weiwei's blog.
Okay.
That is English translations of all of his blog posts that were then taken down. And also Barbara Pollock, who is a leading expert in contemporary Chinese art, and they'll have a great discussion. And then throughout the exhibition, we'll have a variety of events that you can see on imamuseum.org.
Very good. Sarah Green, thank you so much for coming into Art of the Matter.
You are so welcome.
Thanks, real pleasure to chat with you.
Travis DiNicola with the IMA's contemporary art curator, Sarah Green. Ai Weiwei, According to What? Opens this weekend at the IMA. For more information, visit imamuseum.org, imamuseum.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll chat with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's Kirk Trevor.
I'll get a preview of upcoming Broadway Across America series that's coming to Indianapolis.
And WFYI's Scott Hope joins us for a special interview with the ISO's new CEO, Gary Gensling. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar of events we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.